you know, obviously having the communication and realizing that, you know, as you start having these directors of pitching, directors of hitting, these guys are starting to get way more in tune as to some of the things that you've already been working on for the last several years, you know, so they're appreciating there could be a, you know, a functional dysfunction within the kinetic chain and realizing that you may be an avenue to help that player overcome that.
And we are back. So I know you missed us. Took about a month off there. Very difficult getting everyone's schedules aligned. It is the holiday season, so people are pretty busy and running around all hectic. In this interview, we chat with PJ Mainville. He is the head athletic trainer for the Chicago Cubs. PJ's been with the Cubs for about 8 or 9 years now, and he's had a pretty long career in baseball amongst other organizations. I know he's worked with, a little bit with the Orioles and with the Diamondbacks as well. We talk a little bit about the ins and outs of working as a head athletic trainer and all the difficulties and the nuances and just the many different hats that the head trainer has to wear, as well as what PJ will be presenting on this interview I did with my co-host, Brett Winchester. And we should be wrapping up the World Pitching Congress presenters here pretty shortly. So no more long breaks between episodes, and it should be every week up until the event. Without further ado, here is PJ Mainville. All right, so here we're back with the Gestalt Performance Podcast interviewing the presenters for the upcoming World Pitching Congress. Today we have PJ Mainville, head trainer of the Chicago Cubs. PJ, what's going on, man?
Not too much. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, we're excited to talk with you. We also have Brett Winchester, also co-founder of World Pitching Congress and Gestalt Performance, right next to me. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello, everybody.
Yeah, there he is. Now we know to block you out. So PJ, by the way, super excited to have you on. Thanks for taking the time. Just got back from winter meetings, and you know, you guys have been busy running around. And what people don't realize is they think it's the off season for baseball, but you guys are still going full board throughout most of this. If you're not, you know, you maybe get a week or two for vacation, then you're right back at it. So thanks for taking this time to chat with us a little bit.
Yeah, no problem.
So we're just going to run through some questions, and then we'll kind of banter around a little bit. Tell us how you got your start in baseball.
I actually started as a junior in college. So actually was able to get an internship with the Baltimore Orioles down in Sarasota, Florida. At the time, I was looking for an opportunity to do something a little bit different. And the summers obviously lined up really well with professional baseball. I got an opportunity to spend my junior summer down there and also my senior summer before getting hired on with the Orioles on contract for a minor league deal. But really good experience, really got a chance to immerse myself within the rehabilitation, which kind of backward for some guys just getting in the industry. I mean, most of them start with an affiliate and kind of go forward, whereas I spent a lot of time on the rehab front. So, you know, some of the first injuries we saw were obviously, you know, UCL sprains and reconstructions back in that era. But it was a really good experience to get a grasp of how these things have, you know, pretty much progressed over the last several years and currently to what they are now.
Hey, PJ, this is Brett. I was just gonna, I think the listeners would like to know, you're kind of from the famous lineage off of the Crenshaw tree. How important that is. Obviously, you and I spent a weekend with Neil a couple weekends ago in LA and Andrew. And it just seems like everyone who's involved with that original tree has gone on to do great things. Could you maybe talk to us about like the culture that was created and how you've done the same thing with the Cubs, and maybe just say a couple words about that?
You know, I was obviously very blessed to get a chance to be a part of that. You know, Ken's developed quite a process over there with the guys of the Diamondbacks, and I'm clearly a product of that process. When I came on from the Orioles in 2007 was my first year with Arizona. You know, a lot of the different philosophy bases that Ken was already digging on was very new for me. But as a new guy to the organization, I was put into the lead role with the minor leagues as the minor league medical and rehab coordinator. And I was in a position where I actually had to learn it and then actually had to teach it back to the guys that we were hiring because we had such a young group at the time. And, you know, I can remember as we went through the filtering process of year after year of new athletic trainers, I can remember, you know, total experience in that system. We might have had 2 years worth of experience at AA and AAA, 1 year at both of the A-ball clubs, and then no experience at the lower levels. So clearly we had a very young group, and, you know, just the, I guess the culture that Ken has built and teaching those below you to take your job one day was really the driving theme behind, you know, bettering everybody. But, you know, the accountability for you to step into, you know, a learning role and then ultimately teaching was more so the expectation. And I think that's what really was special about our situation that gave us the opportunities to, you know, really kind of flourish within the system, but, you know, realizing that you're trying to help the group and the team. And that's really what it was most about.
Retrospectively, at the time, would you been able to predict that all these people would have gone on and kind of done what they did? Did you know it at the time, or has that surprised you a little bit, or what's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the selection process that we had into this group was very, very, very selective in the sense that when we would interview, all of us would have to agree on the person. So if we had a prospective candidate, we'd all, you know, give them a call, and then at some point we'd roundtable as kind of like the executive group of our team. And then we'd all have to agree. And it was a nice opportunity to kind of, you know, get a perspective. You know, everyone's going to have a different interpretation of that guy. And to really kind of narrow that down, you know, the selection process in the beginning really, I think, helped, you know, really where our process went later on, because you feel like you got the right guy. And there's not 100%, you know, being sure on that, but it definitely, you know, increases the probability as such. And then ultimately from there, just giving those people the opportunities to get better, which, you know, that was kind of the culture. But I would say overall, I don't know if I was surprised as such, just because I was a true believer of the process. But ultimately, you know, to have that many people leave that organization and do what they've done is pretty special, and clearly a credit to Ken and the process that he's established there.
Do you ever rub the World Series ring in, or too soon for that?
No, I don't go there.
Oh, man. So PJ, let's go back a little bit, kind of your upbringing through all this. Was there any type of like event that was like, that put it into perspective, like this is what you want to do for a living, you know, as a profession?
You know, I was kind of your typical, you know, high school athlete type thing, you know, nothing special by any means. But it definitely, you know, I enjoyed sports, playing sports growing up. I've always been fascinated on the medical side as well. And I think that's probably where the two worlds met for me. In college, to be honest with you, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of direction as to what I wanted to do. But, you know, I was fortunate enough at East Carolina University. They did have an accredited athletic training program there. And it was a nice opportunity to kind of go over and check it out. And it definitely drew enough of my interest at the time to want to get involved.
Very good. Kind of going back to education wise, I saw you got your master's in science. Now, do you use any of that for like what, like did that dictate kind of what you learned and kind of help guide you into what you're doing right now? Or was it more of like a stepping stone to get you to the next level?
You know, quite honestly, the reason why I did that is I always, you know, going through the minor leagues, it's such an unsure process, meaning that, you know, from year to year, your contract to contract, and then ultimately, you know, having a backup plan in this industry is always kind of where I've always kind of kept that in the back of my mind. So I always felt like getting your master's degree was, you just gave me the opportunity if I ever stepped out of this industry to go and teach at a college. It really didn't set a direction for me so much. I would say what really set the direction was really kind of thinking outside the box and some of these other subspecialties and areas of thought and philosophy bases that we've kind of studied in the last several years. And clearly, most of that stuff that we've been looking at has been results-based, which fits really nicely into the realm of professional baseball, realizing that timelines are very important. And obviously, you know, when you talk about missed days and millions of dollars lost on a roster, then, you know, clearly that becomes a greater of importance.
Yeah, that's really good. So going back to like that, what Brett asked about kind of with the lineage and what you talked about, how Ken his whole purpose was to get you everyone to create a culture where you're helping people want to kind of take your job. Like you're trying to help grow the people below you to get better and better and better. How do you kind of guide that with this game changing so rapidly into analytics and technology and all the stuff that you need to be able to kind of be up on and then work with your whole staff to make sure they're in the same place?
You know, I've actually given that a lot of thought and over the years. You know, when I left Arizona, believe it or not, this is actually coming up my eighth year with the Cubs. I would say the one thing that we realized is that going through that process in those years, you know, there were so many different things that we were looking at. It was almost like drinking through a fire hose. The information was just, you know, coming at you left and right. And, you know, it was almost like everyone was kind of looking at different things and you didn't want to be left behind. And there was a process of where you're trying to learn it as quickly as you can and try to fit the pieces into the daily, you know, treatments that you'd be providing for the athletes that you're caring for. I think ultimately when I left there, I really had more of a systematic way of laying it out to our staff. You know, I had required through our organization, two continuing education courses, per off season. Now, if they chose to do beyond that, I was more than happy to, you know, approve as such, but I think it was important to set a foundation of a philosophy base within the organization, just so that we weren't looking 180 degrees apart when we're looking at the same athlete. So I think as we built the culture, we were able, you know, the information, we were building the culture at the same time. And it allowed guys just to at least have inner, you know, personal conversations about some of the things we were learning and then how we'd apply it. And then each year we've kind of built upon that thought process. And hopefully, you know, these guys, as they're learning more of these different thought processes, they start to develop their own philosophy base.
You know, PJ, you know, I've seen a majority of the staffs, you know, over the years, and it's interesting. I think you're the most hands-on head trainer that I've come across. And I was wondering, and I know your talent as a manual therapist. I tell everybody, you know, I think you have really gifted hands. So how important has that been for you, you know, over the years, as you could have started to delegate some of the treatment and things like that, but you've kind of chosen to keep your hands, really keep your hands on the player, basically. And, you know, how important you think that is in your model, and if you could comment on that and maybe, you know, the importance of manual therapy.
Yeah, so I feel like I never wanted to become one of those guys in a lead role where, you know, I sat behind a desk or a computer. It's clearly not my passion. Like, I think where an area that I thrive and I really enjoy the most is working with the player individually each day. And the thing that keeps me coming back each and every time is really trying to get a result. Like, you know, the players always talk about their competition on the field, but I guess my competition is in our therapy world. You know, like, how quickly can we take an injury and try to turn that around? And, you know, that becomes the competitive nature of what I think I do in trying to get guys back on the field, obviously safely. But at the same time, trying to push the limits as best we can. Very fortunate to be able to work with guys that are motivated. So that aspect actually comes to play. But as far as the manual therapy, I would say, you know, I think that's the one area that we probably get the best bang for your buck, and you get the treatments results that you're looking for much quicker. And then obviously backing that up through some of the other philosophical bases, you know, with the rehab and ultimately setting processes in place for a return to play. So the manual therapy has become kind of the forefront of what we do. And I think, you know, by allowing us to utilize that in conjunction with therapeutic rehab and ultimately putting that in place with the return to play, I think that's been where some of our strengths have been.
PJ, you talk a lot about the rehab and the return to play aspect of all this with manual therapy. How much do you integrate that with the performance side of knowing, like, hey, this guy's posterior cuff might be a little tight and he's not kind of getting, you know, maybe his spin rate is down or he's doing something compensation wise in his body that's trying to adjust for what he's kind of worn down. Like, how much do you look into that aspect when you're working on somebody?
You know, ultimately that becomes the pulse of the day, to be honest with you. So one of the things that I do during the game is, you know, I'll end up going on the bench for a short period of time, but then I'm going back upstairs and working with our starters. For the most part, we're on a 5-day rotation. with each of the guys on day three. Typically I'm working with that guy, and exactly what you're saying is kind of getting an idea of how they feel and getting a gauge to what the recovery process is during those 5 days. That being said, the reliever is kind of the same thing. So what happens is, you know, those guys will come out of the game, and I try to put myself in a position where I'm interacting with them at the end of the game, especially as we go through multiple relievers, just to get a sense of where they are in their recovery, how they're feeling, because everything information-wise as it sets up for the next day becomes really important. And then it really dictates exactly how we want to put in place any kind of recovery methods. Do they need a day off? And ultimately, you know, with the information that they're giving and obviously what their input is, as it relates to their usage and what they feel, we kind of come up with a solution together as far as what their availability may or may not be in the coming days.
PJ, how much, I know you guys had a big managerial change this upcoming year. Does that change your job at all, or is it too early to tell, or what's your take on that?
You know, I'm very fortunate to have David Ross in the position he's in. I love Joe Madden. There's no question. Joe was probably an amazing person and obviously a really good manager. But with David coming in, I'm pretty excited. I've got a relationship with him already. You know, obviously having him as a player for 2 years of my career, you know, it was nice to see the leadership that he brings and obviously his energy. And, you know, I feel like I've got somewhat of a relationship already established. Now I realize it's going to change a little bit with him being the manager, but I don't anticipate changing much of my day to day unless, you know, for some reason we feel like some other process works better. But, you know, I think the communication comes into play each and every day, and David's really easy to talk to, and, you know, being able to give him the information, let him process it, and then kind of go from there. But I really don't anticipate too many changes. You know, he kind of knows the system. He's been really in the clubhouse quite a bit, actually, the last 3 years, even when he was working with ESPN. So we were able to kind of keep a relationship going during that time.
Perfect. You said that, you know, when we talked last week, you were saying that you were thinking about, or they were going to make some changes in the workout room there in the spring training facility. I think that that's a testament to how you guys are always kind of on the cutting edge of what's next and things like that. So to let everybody know, basically the Cubs, strength and conditioning area now in spring training looks like, you know, kind of like a really awesome traditional gym with great equipment, et cetera. But then, it sounds like you guys are going to do a little, house cleaning. Could you comment on that and where your thoughts are of what the future is for the strength and conditioning of the Chicago Cubs?
Yeah, I think, you know, this becomes an integrated process, you know, between the areas. You know, we hired a director of high performance in the last year, and I really like the ideas that he brings to the table. You know, a lot of the things that we're trying to do as a sports medicine performance team is to provide an environment where we're, you know, collaboratively, as we put together our programming, the best environment for our players to flourish. You know, that being the case, I think ultimately, you know, as you go through and talk to more strength conditioning coaches, you know, space becomes a premium. I don't care whatever facility you're in. And so I think we're going to, you know, look at some of the equipment we currently have in the facility and, you know, try to open it up as much as we can and really try to provide that functional element and obviously trying to become more sports specific, you know, whether it's to put some kind of, you know, simulated mound situation in the weight room, things that we can get as much, you know, sport specific as we can in regards to trying to facilitate the performance side as it dictates, you know, with the strength conditioning world.
Right.
That's pretty cool. I haven't seen anyone be doing that yet. I know there's a lot of organizations right now, and I'm sure you've talked with like Wake Forest Pitching Lab and how they have their whole force plate and 3D motion capture system set up. And a lot of teams are doing that now, but it's everyone's trying to perfect it. The one thing I'm hearing kind of amongst the industry is all these teams are throwing money at some of this tech to identify, you know, objectifiable data and all that, but they have no clue what to do with it. Like what's your approach on that and kind of how do you see that whole issue in baseball right now?
It's definitely the new frontier, that's for sure. I mean, there's clearly a lot of teams that are already banging on that drum. I think we have to this point. I think for us, it's refining the process a little bit more and trying to make it more usable as we go forward. Probably the best example I could give, especially this past season, is, you know, you're constantly in a position of trying to validate, you know, during your rehabilitative programs, as to when we think a guy's ready to perform. And, you know, especially at the level we're at, you know, putting him out in front of 40 some thousand people on national TV, you know, the last thing you want to do is put him in a position where he's had an injury and then you're walking him off the field for the same injury. So obviously some of the things that we try to go through and trying to, you know, establish some of the metrics and the objective measures going forward is, you know, doing some of the isolated strength testing, whether it be a NORD test or counter movement jumps. You know, can we measure and try to get him as close to, you know, his sub-maximal efforts as we can so that we can at least to some degree validate that. And that's one thing that we were able to do with this particular rehab in this past year is actually pull some of that objective data so that we can at least feel a little bit more comfortable. And it doesn't mean that we don't change, we're not changing a ton of what we've already been doing in regards to our rehabilitative process, but it just gives more context and maybe a little more confidence when you put them out there that you have some of these strength numbers and some of these performance numbers under your belt in hopes that, you know, you can fortify their ability to come back and hopefully not have a re-injury.
That's cool. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. What would you say your biggest challenge is day to day as the head trainer?
Quite honestly, I would say it's exactly trying to figure out as much as you can subjectively, objectively, you know, the readiness of a certain player. I think the thing that you appreciate going through a full major league season is that there are very few off days, and, you know, sometimes those off days and, you know, correspond to travel days as well. And so when you're in a position where you're trying to constantly look for recovery means for some of these players, you know, you're in a little bit of a kind of a feel, get a feel of where they are in their process of trying to perform each and every day in hopes of mitigating injury. That's probably where we spend most of our time is, you know, communicating with the players, and whatever we can, trying to look at some of the acute on chronic workload. If we can try to quantify that as best we can is really the trick. And, you know, by no means would I ever use the word predict, because I think that's probably well far beyond our means to do so. But you're constantly looking for things that might, you know, jump up on the radar that might give you some kind of information to the overall wellness of that player.
PJ, when I've been around you and your staff, I mean, I know everyone really looks up to you, and it seems like you're able to get the best out of everybody and to really put everyone kind of in their best position for to succeed. And I know that is really hard to do. From a management standpoint, how have you been able to balance that where you sometimes are dealing with, you know, people who are really good at what they're doing and, you know, they can also have attitudes and opinions. So how do you keep that all under control, and how have you been able to have so much success in that area?
I'd say the first thing is just realizing what you're not good at, because, you know, for me, I try to be as honest with myself as to the areas that I may not be as knowledgeable on, or maybe my skill set isn't. And I'd much rather find somebody that, you know, is better at that. You know, I have a conversation with our PT all the time. You know, he's really good at some of the, you know, subacute phase of return to injury management, where I felt like most of my forte would be in the, you know, the acute injury standpoint. So, you know, we try to balance that throughout our group. And it's not that we're not all involved. It's just, you know, we feel like by giving that person ownership of that moment, you know, you're realizing your limitations, you're giving them the opportunity to show what they can do. And I think it ultimately elevates your team, because everyone has a place and everyone feels like they're, you know, a piece of that. And by doing that, you just give them opportunities to flourish in their areas. And I think that's something, by giving that ownership, really helps in the overall confidence of the team.
PJ, you guys have a state-of-the-art facility both in Arizona for spring training, as well as you rebuilt out your training facility in Chicago recently. What would you say is your most valuable recovery tool or resource that you guys use that you get the most bang for your buck out of?
I think it's probably a combination of multiple things. You know, I think really every player is probably different. When it comes to that, you know, I don't know there's one particular modality. I think there's just so many different things that come into play, and some guys respond better to other modality-based treatments. You know, ultimately for us, we take a premium to sleep and obviously nutrition and, you know, appreciating, you know, days off and the recovery aspect of it. But, you know, when you start adding in some of the, you know, other modalities, whether it be, you know, a cryo chamber in combination with a hyperbaric, in combination with infrared lights, you know, for the local area of soreness, you know, we kind of use those in combination. We like that. It's actually worked out pretty well for us. Overall, I think the other premium and we spend most of our time on is probably the manual soft tissue, which gives you a hands-on feel for how the tissue is responding. And ultimately, you get that immediate feedback from that player at that moment. So I think combination of a lot of those different elements come to play. But clearly, the hands-on with the manual therapy probably gives us the most information.
Yeah, I think, PJ, you got a lot of little tricks. I mean, my favorite story, and we don't have to name the player's name, but the day that I spent with you guys at the stadium at the end of the year, and a certain player had an insane inversion ankle sprain. And I remember after seeing it, really, you know, kind of thinking, you know, this dude's going to be out for, you know, a couple of weeks because he ruptured his ATFL and other things. And you know, had this little trick. And then he was, I think that was a Sunday. Didn't he play on Wednesday, maybe?
Yeah, he did.
So, I mean, there's like a lot of these little tricks. And I mean, and I've been at this 20 years, but it's always fascinating to me. I think it's just a testament to like somebody in the world always knows something more than you know? And I mean, that was like a really good example of that. So, anyways, I think that was at least fascinating, for me to watch, but, on stuff like that and other things, I mean, what's your go-to as far as like learning different things? Like how are you currently educating yourself?
You know, I think getting around people, you know, I've always kind of described it to our staff as kind of, you know, who are your friends, you know, and really kind of making sure that you're on the inner circle of the guys that are on the forefront of the industry. Because, you know, some of the conversations you might have may not be a direct reflection of what they said, but it's how you apply it. And I think ultimately, like, you've got your own thought process and your own philosophy base, but that little piece of information might be able to be plugged into your philosophy base, which maybe betters your situation. So I'm constantly thinking on those lines of trying to, you know, I guess, listen to others as much as I can, because I think, you know, clearly, like you said, there's a lot of people out there that know way more than I do on it. On certain elements. So I feel like, you know, listening and being able to have the conversation, because I think there's more to the game in terms of, you know, listening and asking and maybe put your ego to the side of what you know versus what they might know. And I think the more that you're able to do that, it's going to give you more opportunities to build relationships and ultimately hopefully learn something.
Yeah, that's well said.
PJ, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but what was that little trick that you used for manual therapy wise for the ankle sprain?
It actually wasn't, you know, manual therapy, but why don't you divulge, PJ?
a lot of what we've been doing is a program years ago. It does actually have the beginnings of a manual therapy component where you're really just trying to desensitize the areas that are really symptomatic. And obviously, a guy coming out of a game acutely, I don't think there was maybe after X-rays and maybe an initial round of just icing it for pain measures. We started into our therapeutic treatment, and a lot of it is just really trying to downregulate the sensitivity of the areas that are injured. And a lot of that's done just by pressure. And so, you know, spending a lot of time to downregulate that in hopes that the symptoms in the next day, because right at that moment, you're getting the information you have, realizing there's going to be a huge acute inflammatory response. And if you can mitigate what is going to come in tomorrow, the next day, really gives you the opportunity or hopefully a head start going into your, you know, day after that 24 to 48 hour period, which I think gives you a nice starting point. So obviously downregulating it, appreciating, you know, the thought process of Lawrence Jones, his strain counter strain as it relates to the ankle sprain, downregulating, you know, the agonist antagonist relationships. And then ultimately, really trying to reset the talus within the ankle through a distraction band program that gives us the opportunity to get the ankle moving quickly. And again, this is after a process of ensuring that, you know, the guy doesn't have a fracture. Our physicians have already taken a look at him and felt, you know, like he's in a position where it is, you know, whatever degree of ankle sprain it is, feel comfortable enough beginning the therapeutic process.
Cool. Thanks for that. Who would you say are some of your personal and professional influences? I know we've talked about Ken a little bit, but is there anybody else that like's really been an influence for you?
I would say overall, I mean, it's really coming off that Arizona tree. I mean, everyone that I've had the opportunities to kind of, you know, speak with, kind of opened up all the doors. So, you know, when you start talking about the idea of, you know, DNS and Pavel Kolaj and that group, you know, that's been very influential to me. I mean, I think that's where, you know, a lot of our network has really expanded, you know, from, and then obviously from the PRI side. I think what happens is your network starts to grow, kind of what we were talking about earlier. You know, you start to realize that some of these other people and these other subsets are very influential in the way you may think in the future. So I think that's probably, you know, I can remember sitting down, you know, Ken had brought in Tom Myers at one point, and it was really interesting to hear, you know, his thoughts. And at the time we were studying a lot of his work and, you know, appreciating the spiral lines and the, you know, the anatomy trains as we such, you know, learned, but you realize that's a building block to a lot of other stuff, like the fascial manipulation with Stecco's work. So everything's kind of built on itself. And I think each one have been influential in their own way. And I think the way I look at it more and more is like the more you can separate yourself from becoming just a PRI guy or a DNS guy and becoming more integrative, I think that's ultimately where you become a really good clinician, because then you're not, you know, stuck in the one groove, that you're able to kind of, you know, mix and match and be able to jump from one philosophy base to another.
Tell, if you don't mind sharing the story, I liked your story you told. I think you were in maybe Los Angeles. I don't know. When did you run into Stan Conte? Wasn't it like really early in your career at a coffee shop or something when you were writing a chapter for a book or something?
Yeah. So, Ken was really good about, you know, putting you in a position of, being uncomfortable. And that's one thing I try to continue to do. But, you know, the part of that process is we had agreed, through Leon Chetau to do a revision in his book. It was Muscle Energy Techniques, the fourth edition, chapter 11. So I can remember sitting there, and it was the four of us that were going to do it. It was Neil Ramp, Ken Crenshaw, and Nate Shaw. And, myself being the young guy on the staff at the time was pretty much pitched the ball at that point. And so I can remember, you know, Ken going, "Hey, go ahead, get started. Go ahead and get started. 40% of this is going to have to change." So I can remember getting this, and I'm sitting down in a coffee shop, and lo and behold, this is a time when Stan Conte was still the head trainer of the LA Dodgers. I can remember he's sitting over on the, you know, against the window at this coffee shop, and I sit down in front of my computer, and I just constantly am just like typing, delete, 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 typing, delete, delete. And then you just realize how difficult that process is. But then ultimately kind of getting back past that writer's block and going forward, it was a great growth experience for me. Probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. You realize what you're writing is going to be in, you know, in print for quite a long time. So, you know, I think ultimately, you know, putting position, getting guys in an uncomfortable situation to as room for growth is really what I learned from that experience.
Just kind of bringing it full circle too. I always have a lot of respect for people that seem to have everything together besides professionally. You're happily married, your kids are doing well. And, what's the key to keeping everything in balance in, PJ's life? What are some successful, pieces of advice that you would recommend for people who are aspiring to do what you do or something of the sort?
This is definitely not a trick question. I know what the answer here. I definitely give 100% credit to my wife, because I'm very, very fortunate in that realm. There's no way I could do what I do without her. My gosh, she runs the ship. There's no question. I'm blessed to have, you know, my wife here and her ability to, you know, do all the things that she does.
Well, because in all honesty, I mean, they really, I mean, for those of you who don't understand like what it takes to be married to a trainer, I mean, they're sacrificing a lot.
Yeah. I could definitely put her on the phone and she could go for a while.
Get her on the phone.
Yeah. You might hear some things you don't want to hear.
Exactly. Get her on the phone.
Oh, no, it's definitely the big one for me is, she's, definitely been the corner of this household. So, you know, we work as a team, and, you know, appreciate that it's not every day is not always easy, but, you know, you try to work through those things and, you know, do your best to kind of, you know, the quality over quantity in terms of the family life that you're able to bring, in hopes that, you know, someday that, you know, your kids appreciate, you know, the work and the effort you've put in. But, I think that's the hardest thing, is just being away from your family. Mm-hmm. So,
PJ, you've been in the game for over 20 years now, right? Since 98, I mm-hmm. think.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot has changed as far as training, as far as surgery standards, as far as performance measures. Guys are throwing harder and harder than ever. What have you seen trend-wise as far as injuries goes over the last 20 years?
I think from the injury, I think quite honestly, just as much the surgeries have gotten more efficient, you know, and I think, you know, looking back to, you know, doing shoulder, capsular shrinkages of the shoulder. I mean, I can remember when that was a huge topic and a huge issue. And, you know, we struggled through the rehabilitation process to try to get the range of motion. You know, I think the evolutions in that side of it have definitely helped the rehabilitative process. I think more and more, the other thing is that there's been more of a premium placed on holistic care of the athlete and appreciating how the adaptive patterns over time have come to play. And ultimately I think are looked upon as maybe possible injury, maybe sources of somewhere the injuries may be coming from. So I think we're looking at trying to get more efficient movement, and then ultimately, you know, hopefully that transpires to performance. But I think that's really where the keen eye is more and more coming into play. And, you know, Brett and I have spent a lot of time together just, you know, looking at some of that stuff. Is, you know, you look at inefficient movement patterns, and, you know, you can try to correlate whether or not you think that's going to, you know, ultimately lead to poor performance or ultimately put a higher stress on a joint. I think really trying to, you know, establish as well as you can, you know, good motor patterns and ultimately good, you know, function is kind of where I think the game has changed and put the premium on it. You look at all the screening tools that we have now, in terms of all the functional movement screens as such, and realizing that, you know, people are looking at that more closely. Whereas years and years ago, people would look at posture and think you're, you know, standing out in left field by yourself. So I think that's where the game's changed. I think people are appreciating that more. And, you know, what's funny is you can see these adaptive patterns from player to player to player that you work with.
Could you also comment, PJ? It seems to me like the baseball trainer role, especially at the professional level, has changed so much where, you know, back in, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago, it seemed like it was more kind of a traditional trainer's role. But now I think you need to know like all the salt of the earth baseball things. And yet you're also have all this pressure to be great, you know, a manual therapist, great with therapeutic exercise. Can you talk about how that's also kind of evolved and changed, and some young trainers who are out there, like what the future of being a baseball trainer probably looks like for the next 5 years, maybe?
You know, I think a lot of that comes to, you know, it's not going to be a scenario where, you know, you might go to one conference in the off season and maybe two. And, you know, I think what's happening is to your point, I think there's, situation where you're going to need to put more of an emphasis on your development and your skill sets, because ultimately that's what's going to carry over to the players that you're managing and treating every day. Unfortunately, the off season is no longer an off season. You know, we're constantly looking at, you know, player free agent reviews, but then at the same time, you're trying to get better in the off season by going to different conferences, and then trying to put that practical application into the programming that you're trying to develop for the coming season. It's a constant effort now, whereas I would say even the last 5 years, it's changed even in that time, where it's definitely become more of a year in, year out process. There really doesn't become this downtime that we once had. Now it's become a scenario where you're constantly either trying to get better, or you've got the daily duties of the organization. But ultimately, what kind of programming you can put into, you know, place for the coming season to better your organization.
Going along with that premise, as well as kind of what we talked about, how, you know, putting together a good organization, a good culture, how do you balance everything when there's so many new positions coming in that have never existed before? You know, there's a pitch design consultant or a pitch design director, and there's a sports or there's a pitching science director, and there's all these different kind of avenues or different directions that you have to be able to manage and have them all speaking the same language. What's the difficulty of all that?
It's definitely become more complex. So I think for us, you know, first and foremost, you need to be try to be as good as you can within your own area first. And I think that's where we're trying to elevate our level each and every year, is trying to become better, you know, in the medical area and rehabilitation area. Ultimately, you know, you realize there's a lot of spillover into these other domains. And, you know, obviously the ideal world of you know, collaboration and realizing that everyone's going to have this crossover is super important. And, you know, obviously having the communication and realizing that, you know, as you start having these directors of pitching, directors of hitting, these guys are starting to get way more in tune as to some of the things that you've already been working on for the last several years. You know, so they're appreciating there could be a, you know, a functional dysfunction within the kinetic chain, and realizing that you may be an avenue to help that player overcome that. And so I think those are where the worlds meet. And obviously that collaborativeness that you work in hopes of elevating the player's overall performance is kind of where that's met.
Yeah, I think like 10 of my direct, you know, close friends have been scooped up by major league organizations just this off season. So it's weird to see all the different disciplines taking different roles, you know, from, like I said, pitch design or like pitch science or some form of integrative position. And I'm seeing like, you know, these are physical therapists and chiropractors and strength coaches that are doing all different aspects of it that are, you know, the kind of along the lines of what I like to call the performance therapist, where you can combine, you know, like you said, movement with maybe some manual therapy, some rehab stuff, as well as understanding, you know, how to be a more effective pitcher or how to get a certain spin axis on something or know what it means if there's a certain spin rate on a certain pitch, and kind of combining all of those ideologies into one. There's a lot more of the, it's hard to say it's a generalist when it's also kind of a specialist.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I'm very fortunate with the staff that I have and work around that we can have those conversations. You know, I would say baseball, where it's been, you know, many years ago, was, you know, the analogy was always stay in your lane or keep your rake in there in your own backyard. Whereas now, I don't know that's quite an option. You know, I mean, the ability to talk pitching mechanics as from the standpoint of functional movement is now a very common conversation between myself and our major league pitching coach. But I think there's an understanding as well. Like, I'm not there to be a pitching coach. I'm there to highlight where a movement limitation could be affecting the pitching motion. And so, you know, we're able to have those and vice versa. You know, he'll come to me just the same. He goes, you know, I'm noticing that, you know, he just can't get through his front side. I'm like, well, okay, why don't we take a look at this and then, you know, check that out. And ultimately I'll get back to you. And I think that's where the game's changed, you know, 100% over now, because now those conversations are encouraged. Whereas before, you know, I think there was a lot of territorial type, you know, premise behind it before where you didn't even want to have that conversation. But now it's become the norm to make sure that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely the trend. So a couple more questions. I know we'll get out of here, get you out of our hair in a second. Do you have any books or resources you could recommend to our listeners as far as professional or, you know, rehab or whatever that, you know, you think is something that's worth your time?
You know, I that's a loaded question, right? I mean, there's just so many different things out there. I think honestly, like, I think you go with what you like initially. You know, I really enjoy, you know, from the manual therapy standpoint, I love the fascial distortion model with Casey Hummel. I really love the DNS with the Pavel collage. I think, you know, ultimately the PRI brings in another dynamic of the rehabilitative and assessment. I think trying to build upon those areas are really important. But again, I would encourage you not to become that guy. I think really in trying to get across all these different domains and worlds and build your own philosophy base, because every scenario that it presents to you is going to be a combination of those different thought processes. You know, I don't know, I mean, in terms of an actual book per se, You know, there's so many different things that we're looking at day in and day out. I think it's more philosophical, is just trying to keep building upon your repertoire of trying to be able to bring application to the day-to-day treatments that you're providing for those players.
Well said. Well said. What would you recommend a student that's trying to get into baseball, get into athletic training? What would you recommend they do first to kind of get the ball rolling?
You know, I think any opportunity that you have to, you know, make that initial phone call, whether, you know, I always look at it as like an opportunity to, that's what you want to be in the future, reaching out to that person in that position. You might get there and realize that's not for you, or you might get there and you go, wow, like I really want to do this. And I think creating your own avenues and being your own advocate, because a lot of, you know, a lot of the natural human tendency is just like, nah, I don't want to bother him, or nah, I'm not good enough, or whatever the case may be. But if you have a sincere interest in wanting to become what you want to become, I think you got to trial it. And I think you have to go through the process of putting yourself out there a little bit. And ultimately, making those connections opens up the networking tree, and you know, you never know where that's going to lead.
Yeah, I got one more. We'll see what Brad has to say here in a second, but I got one more. What game 7 of the World Series when Roger Davis hit that home run? What was going through your head?
I about threw up. True story.
Oh my gosh, I could only imagine.
No, I mean, that was definitely a deflated moment, that's for sure. But man, oh man, the resilience of the guys that were there, that was a really special moment. And, you know, it couldn't have had any more, you know, drama to it as it did, which was essentially, you know, obviously the rain delay, and then the Jason Hayward, you know, conversation with everybody and the players. You know, I think that's what was special, is the resilience side of it, and the guys coming together, and obviously the outcome that came of that.
Yeah, I'd say it worked out pretty well in your favor.
Yeah, no doubt. No, extremely appreciative to the organization and obviously the players that were there. That's for sure.
Amazing. Well, PJ, thank you so much for your time today. Can we get a slight sneak peek on what your World Pitching Congress presentation might be?
You know, my ideas are to try to take it as practical as possible. I want to do an introduction to a more of a case study type scenario with a shoulder impingement. And then ultimately, you know, try to approach a little bit of the why, and then, you know, the application of how we would manage it.
Can't wait. Brett, you got anything else?
No, just, no, I really always appreciate hanging out with you, PJ. We're really looking forward to, January, and, we will get caught up then. Thanks again for taking the time to do this for us.
Yeah, no problem. Enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Anything else you want to get off your chest before we go?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. All right, PJ. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Take care, guys.
Later, PJ.
See ya.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
So there you have it from PJ Mainville. If you still haven't got your tickets yet, we have registrations open until a week before the event. I think that's January 10th, I believe, 10th or 11th. You can actually talk to me in person if you're down in Nashville at the beginning of the year at the ABCA convention. I will have a little space at the P3 booth. So come find the P3 booth. We'll be running a event-only discount for the World Pitching Congress. That's at the ABCA convention in Nashville. Other than that, hope to see you in St. Louis in middle of January, and we'll continue there. If you're a player or coach and you're looking for a more efficient way to warm up, check out our free dynamic warm-up ebook. This warm-up consists of evidence-based movements revolved around neuromuscular stability and fascial slings. You can download it off of our website, or just go to the Gestalt Performance Twitter page and follow the link.